Welcome to Shattering Myths. This is the program where we expose the misconceptions which are associated with religion and politics, even patriotism, as well as military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to explain why these things are happening, what these things have in common, and what they portend for our future. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His covenant. We will replace religion with reason. Our phone number for this program, if you would like to call in and question, criticize, or affirm anything that I have to say, is 877-300-7645. And for those just looking for verification of the perspective that is being brought to bear on this very unique radio program, I would encourage you to go to intro2god.org. Terrorism became the pivotal issue during the last presidential debate. And because we use a term incorrectly, we apply a tactic as if it were the enemy. The challenger, Mitt Romney, was embarrassed when in fact it should have been the President of the United States that was embarrassed. In fact, on The Daily Show last night, John Daly knows full well that the President of the United States lied to the American people following the attack. John Stewart, I'm sorry, on The Daily Show, knew that the President of the United States lied to the American people about what happened in Benghazi. And yet, he still wouldn't take ownership of it. There's this notion that if you call an act terrorism, that you have defined the enemy. All that does is misapply a term. You can't fight a war against terrorism. Terrorism is a tactic. You have to fight, if you're going to do so, against the source of whatever is afflicting or assailing you as a people or a nation. And yet we are unwilling to identify, to disclose, to admit the one common theme and 99.99% of terrorist acts being perpetrated in the world today. And it's our corruption of our terminology that has put us in this fix. You know, if terrorism were the enemy, then you'd have to go to the birthplace of democracy to find the most terrorist of nations. That would be Sparta. Sparta is the first nation to embrace democracy. Sparta had the longest surviving democracy, and Sparta was perhaps the most terrorist nation ever to exist on this planet. Then you could go to the nation that brought us the notion of a representative government, a republic, a government of law. Well, Rome became the ultimate perpetrator of terrorism for centuries thereafter. Then you could turn to the largest religious organization in human history, the organization that has lasted longer than any other kind of singular institution in human history, to be the Roman Catholic during the better part of 1,000 years after the fall of Imperial Rome. The Roman Catholic Church was the primary perpetrator of terrorism. They used torture to get people to comply. If we move to modern history, we know that the Nazis began their conquests with terrorist tactics. They attacked and destroyed civilian communities, razing them. It was then the Americans who responded in kind. We firebombed German cities. We firebombed Japanese cities. The war that had begun with the Nazis perpetrating terrorist acts closed with Americans taking terrorism to levels never even envisioned by humankind. Today, the tactic of terrorism is a virtual monopoly. There is one group of people, one institution, responsible for greater than 99% of the world's terrorist acts. Therefore, if we try to understand who is trying to terrorize us and we want to constrain it, we have to come to understand and admit and deal with the inspiration behind 99% of today's terrorist acts. I'm going to share four or five stories that were all headlined in the news today. And I will ask you, after I have shared these stories, what is the one thing they have in common? First comes from CNN. A young woman had her head chopped off for refusing to prostitute herself. And one of her killers was her mother-in-law, police say. The other one was the mother-in-law's cousin. And both admitted, gleeful about it, according to the Afghan police. To most people, the slaying of a 20-year-old girl, this Ma Ghul, is unimaginable. But it's just, and I quote, one more incident that highlights the violent atmosphere that women and especially girls face in Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East. Suzanne Nussel, executive director of Amnesty International USA, said Thursday. So I guess now you have a choice. You can say the problem that led to this is the Middle East. It's hot there. People are bothered. You can say it's Afghanistan. It's rocky there. The only crop that seems to grow is poppies. Or maybe it's the religion that dominates the culture of Afghanistan. Well, the killing happened this week in the Herat province in the southwest Afghanistan along the Iranian border. Ghul's husband was a baker. When he left for work, his mother and her cousin tried to force the young wife into prostitution. When she wouldn't do it, they beheaded her. In a statement, Nussel said the women and the girls in the region are routinely raped. They're killed. They're forced into marriages as a child. They're prevented from obtaining an education. They're denied every right. He says until basic human rights are guaranteed, these horrible abuses will continue to be committed. So why did this occur in Afghanistan? The U.S. State Department says some Afghan women and girls are subjected to forced prostitution, forced marriages, including forced marriages in which husbands force their wives into prostitution, and where they're given by their families to settle debts or disputes, sold as chattel, like you'd sell a goat. Some families even knowingly sell their children, their girls, into forced prostitution, the State Department said, including for bachi bazi, where wealthy men use groups of young boys for social and sexual experimentation. In 2011, people around the world were appalled to learn that a then 13-year-old girl, Shahar Ghul, had been married off to a member of the Afghan army. Shahar said that her husband raped her, then became enraged when she didn't immediately conceive. So her in-laws locked her in a basement for months. They tortured Zahar with hot pokers. They ripped out her nails. Ultimately, she said they wanted to force her into prostitution as punishment for failing her obligation as a Muslim woman. Her face was made famous on Time's cover. You can still imagine the young Aisha. Hauntingly beautiful on that cover. Well, she's had her nose and ears hacked off for running away from her husband's house. She has been brought to the United States, but her life is hugely challenging, foreverly, emotionally, and physically scarred by the abuse that she suffered. What does that story have in common with this next one? A huge car bomb has killed at least 8 people and injured 78 in Beirut, Lebanon, state media report. The explosion occurred in a public square during the, which was part of a mainly Christian district in the capital. All right. So now we have Afghanistan and we have Lebanon. The victim was a young girl in one case, tortured by her mother-in-law. Another was a woman tortured by her husband for failing, both for failing to engage in prostitution. And now we have moved to Lebanon. So it's not the country that they have in common, is it? This time the victim was a Christian community. The next item in the news this morning, a massive roadside bomb killed at least 18 people, mostly women and children, on their way to a wedding. At least 15 others were wounded, in what the BBC correspondent called one of the worst such attacks in a very long time. Next item in the news. A suicide bomber kills two guards as he blew himself up outside of a mosque in a restive southern province of Iran on Friday. That would be today, after morning prayers, just as the suicide bomber in Beirut was murdering women and children after Friday morning prayers. His goal, this one, was to prevent Shia Muslims from entering the mosque. The bomber set off his explosive belt a few hundred yards outside of the Imam Hussein Mosque. Hussein is the grandchild of Muhammad, favored in Shia Islam, killing two members of that community. Eyewitnesses said that the attacker was trying to get inside the mosque, but was identified by members of the mosque and therefore was precluded. Six children sustained severe injuries as a result of this explosion. This community is near the border of Pakistan and has a history of unrest, with the mostly Sunni Muslim population of this community complaining of discrimination at the hands of Iran's Shiite Muslim authorities. Attacked by two suicide bombers at the same mosque in 2010, 39 people were killed, almost all women and children, during a religious ceremony. We'll continue to share stories, and you can guess what the common thread is between them after the break. Good morning. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Turning to a another country, but the same culture, we find in Pakistan that one of the Taliban's most feared commanders, Maulana Fazullah, carefully briefed two assassins from his special hit squad on their target, which, as we know now, was a 14-year-old Pakistani schoolgirl who angered the mighty Taliban by speaking out for Western-style girls' education. Now, what's the contrast between Western-style education for girls and Middle Eastern-style education for girls? What would be the thing that would have shaped the West versus the Middle East? Christianity over the West? Perhaps representative government, freedom over the West? And Islam, submission, fascism over this region known as the Middle East? So we have a clue here as to what the common thread might have been. The article goes on to say the shooting of Malala was the culmination of years of campaigning that had pitted the young girl against one of Pakistan's most ruthless commanders. Their story began in 2009 when Fazlullah, known as Radio Mullah for his fiery radio broadcasts, took over the Swat Valley and ordered the closure of girls' schools. Now, why would this fella, who is a mighty fighter on behalf of Allah, want girls' schools closed? He's a fundamentalist Muslim. He is an advocate of Sharia law, pure Islamic law from the Quran and Hadith. And so why do you suppose that among his first acts would be to stop girls from going to school? Do you think that maybe Islam might have influenced that decision, prioritizing the poor treatment of girls, treating women as if they have nothing to offer other than using them to manufacture suicide bombers? Well, outraged, the then 11-year-old girl kept a blog for the BBC under the pen name and later launched a campaign for girls' education. Now, the truth is that when she was 11, the Taliban had been ousted, but, truth often suffers when we're dealing with the BBC. A military offensive pushed the Taliban out of Swat in 2009, but his men simply melted away across the border to Afghanistan. Now, that's kind of an interesting statement, isn't it? The United States went into Afghanistan to push the Taliban out of Afghanistan. We pushed them ostensibly back into Pakistan, where they were born. So now when times get tough for the Taliban in Pakistan, where do they go? Where is it easiest and freest for them to operate? Afghanistan. Now that tells you a lot about how successful the United States has been in its invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. Earlier this year, they kidnapped, this is the Taliban, kidnapped and beheaded 17 Pakistani soldiers in just one raid. Well, so we have another beheading. This time 17 Muslim men were beheaded as opposed to a Muslim girl who wouldn't prostitute herself. But the common theme here seems to be a lot of beheadings. The Taliban say that's why they sent the assassins. We had no intent to kill the little girl, but we were forced to when she wouldn't stop. You see, they couldn't use their words. No, because in this particular culture, the example that is given by their prophet, which is memorialized as the basis of Sharia law, is that when someone says something you don't like that is opposed to your religion, you don't debate with them, you kill them. So we had to kill her, said the spokesperson for the Taliban. He said the Taliban held a meeting a few months ago in which they unanimously agreed to kill her. Oh, democracy in the Taliban. The task was given to military commanders to carry out. Of course, you need a military commander when you're going to go kill a 14-year-old girl who is unarmed. The military, this militia, has a force of more than 100 men who are specialized as assassins. Now, this is a religious organization, the Taliban. They have a group of men who are specialized as assassins, as part of their religious devotion. For this particular mission, they chose two men, aged between 20 and 30, who were locals from the community. The gunmen had proved their worth in carrying out previous assassinations, a holy duty in this culture. And we'll return to this story on what Islam does to one's soul after the break. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're covering a series of stories, hoping that we can find the common thread that runs between them, and maybe then we can inform those running for public office for President of the United States who is behind the terrorist attacks that we see perpetrated throughout the world. Well, in this particular case, it was the Taliban in Pakistan, and they had chosen a gunman who had proved their worth through previous assassinations, killing opposition politicians and attacking a hotelier for obscenity. Oh, that's a religious term. Yes, the hotelier was killed through an assassination by this religious organization for the obscenity of promoting tourism. Now, it's not obscene to prostitute your wife, not obscene to behead her. It's not obscene to send armed men, assassins from your religious club, to go kill a little girl. But it is obscene to promote tourism. Another trademark of these assassins as part of this religious organization is to kill by shots to the head. Such hits, although dangerous, are also a badge of honor among the Taliban. Yeah, you know, going after little girls on a school bus, that's and when you're armed, that's a dangerous thing to do. So it takes a lot of courage. The fighters, you're a fighter when you carry a gun and board a school bus to shoot unarmed little girls. The fighters who carry them out often receive personal calls of congratulations from senior leaders of this religious organization, and they're also rewarded with cash and guns. Now that they had failed to kill the little girl, her father was now the target, the Taliban spokesperson said. Yes, he's the headmaster of a girls' school, and he's now on their hit list for speaking out against them, his activities to promote peace in the region, and for encouraging his daughters make him worthy of assassination. Here's a quote from this religious organization. We have a clear-cut stance. Anyone who takes sides with the government is against us, and they will have to die at our hands. Ahmad warned, you will see. Other important people will soon become our victims. Now, there was another item in the news that just popped up on BBC. An armed gunman shouting Allahu Akbar just entered a hotel in Shingahar, which is in the Kashmir district, where that is governed by India, and began shooting and killing people. Returning to the story, though, that we just left, this is an interesting update on it. It says, while most, or it actually doesn't say most, while some Pakistanis are outraged by the attack on the little girl, some religious leaders and other political leaders in the Pakistani government have described the assault on Malala, the young little girl that was shot in the head. Well, they've said that the assault, even though it was claimed by the Taliban, even though it was perpetrated by the Taliban, even though the Taliban acknowledged that they had done this and explained the reason that they had done it and said that if she doesn't die, they'll go after her again. Now, the political and religious leaders in this society are so upside down in their thinking. They've described the assault as an American conspiracy designed to trigger a military offensive against militant groups. So they're saying that, really, the Taliban, who said they were going to do it, who planned to do it, who did it, and now have gloated about doing it, that no, the Taliban really didn't do it. It was an American conspiracy. And this American conspiracy was all designed to turn the Pakistani government troops against the Taliban militias. That's how stupid this particular religion makes its people. Moving on, we have another related story to this story, also in Pakistan. It says the alleged organizer of the Taliban shooting of a Pakistani schoolgirl, he was captured in 2009 during a military offensive against the Islamist group. But he was released 3 months later. He was captured. They knew exactly what he was intending to do. They knew who he was. They knew what he was sponsoring. They captured him, held him for 3 months, released him. Believed to be in his 30s, and this is not an organizer, this is actually a perpetrator. The media had it wrong. Abdullah is on the run, and he has also fled to neighboring Afghanistan, where it's much safer to be a Pakistani Taliban member than it is in Pakistan, evidently. He said he organized the attacks on the orders of one of the Taliban's most feared commanders, Baluna Fazullah. Critics say that Pakistan's low conviction rate, it would be zero conviction rate, of militants who commit murder, even of the high-profile ones who carried out major terrorist attacks, is one of the reasons why extremism has spread in Pakistan. So, I guess we could say that the common thread between all of these hideous terrorist and inhuman assaults is extremism. Or you could probably say, well, maybe the problem is Islam. This is an interesting story. It is from the same part of the world. It reveals why, when you don't understand the motivations behind these atrocities, that you are put in a place where you end up sponsoring them, aiding and abetting them. This article is from the New York Times. It actually goes back several days. Dateline is Kabul, Afghanistan. The first thing Colonel Akbar Stanzigai does when he interviews new recruits for the Afghan National Army is to take a look at their cell phones. He checks to see if their ringtones are Taliban campaign tunes, if the screensavers show the white Taliban flag on a black background. By the way, in Islam, if you read the Hadith, you will see that the white flag is the flag of terror in Islam. It's what Muhammad raised when he wanted his Muslims to go terrorize a community. Or if the phone memory includes any insurgent beheading videos. Ah, there's nothing that inspires a good warrior like a good beheading perpetrated under Quranic quotes. Often enough, they flunk that first test, but that hardly means they will not qualify to join the country's manpower-hungry military. Now at its biggest size yet, at nearly 200,000, the Afghan army is so plagued with desertions and low reenlistment rates that it has to replace a third of its entire force every year. A third. Desertions. A third of the force every year. That means that this force that America is saying, oh, we're going to build so that we can go leave Afghanistan, in 3 years it would be zero. A third of them disappear every year. You spend all the money to train them. You pay them a wage that exceeds any wage they can make in their society. The wage is being paid by the American taxpayer. We're arming and equipping them. We're teaching them how to kill. We're making them very effective killers. And they simply walk away. Yes, Scott?
I would probably stop that training program. Probably wouldn't be something I would keep doing. Because I'm assuming they're walking away to go to this other, to the Taliban and things along that nature.
Not all of them, but a significant percentage of them, we've armed and trained them to be effective killers for the Taliban. But others, they simply left because terror works. Because the Taliban has been effective in terrorizing them and their parents and their children and their wives. And they recognize that that's part of the problem. But you know, in this article, we're actually going to find out why a number of them walk away. Now, it's not all walking away to join the Taliban. It says, in fact, I'm going to go directly to that. It says that the United States conducted a series of investigations to find out why so many people have left. And they this is to what the recruits have said, that most of the people who have deserted complained. They said, you know, it's not that I didn't want to be part of this, but after I joined, I saw the situation as it really was. It's nothing but corruption. The officers are busy stealing money that was supposedly going to arm us to defeat the insurgents, but the officers simply steal it. A typical swindle described by the deserters was the diversion of money allocated to commanders to pay for food, which is usually procured locally rather than distributed from a central depot. It says half the time we would get rice with a bone in it, and that would be it. The money was confiscated. People who join the Army, according to most of the interviews, said, just lose hope. He said, those who have given themselves to this cause, who signed up their sons, find that they turn out to be ghosts. They're killed. They simply disappear. And the comment is, again, another quote, everyone is trying to make money on this, to line their pockets and build big houses before Americans leave and take their money away. The final straw, according to these interviews, came when a local villager pointed out that after his unit had killed a local Taliban commander, I started getting phone calls from the Taliban saying, we know who you are, and we're going to kill you. He deserted and called the Taliban to say they didn't have to worry about him any longer. Now, another said, the Army can do nothing on its own without the equipment, the supplies, and the direction of the Americans. Without the Americans and their air support, all of these 200,000 Afghan National Army members are for naught. Such is the case when you're trying to arm and train Muslims to defeat fundamentalist Islam. I am Yada. This is Shattering Mist. We have Larry with us on the phone, and he'll join us after the break. Please stay with us. Back to the final segment of Shattering Mist, the final segment of the news hour of Shattering Mist. We'll go on and talk about a subject much more uplifting in the second hour. The conclusion of this story about recruitment and the lack of retention in the Afghan National Army, where the recruits are paid about twice what they would earn doing any other job paid by the United States, and they're given nearly a 25% raise if they reenlist, and they're not reenlisting. This is the statement by the man responsible for recruiting. He says the news of the American withdrawal has weakened our morale, and of course it has boosted the morale of the enemy, who he also will not name. I am sorry to speak so frankly, but if the international community abandons us again, we won't be able to last. Remember Vietnam? Where in Vietnam we promised that we would not abandon the South Vietnamese, that we established a puppet government, we armed and paid for a South Vietnamese army to fight the communist in our stead, and we said, oh, we will continue to supply you with all the weapons and all the money and all the bullets that you need to continue to sustain this fight. 6 months later, the Congress pulled the plug, and 6 months after that, they were annihilated by the communists in the North. I asked Scott during the break what he thought the chances were that the same thing would happen in Afghanistan. I say there are 100. Scott's considerably more optimistic than I am and said they are 95%. So, Larry, did you see a common thread between all of these atrocities that had been perpetrated, or should we just say that they're all unrelated?
I saw a pretty common thread there. There was another article I read not too long ago that talked about three 12-year-old girls in Indonesia that were Christian girls, and they were on their way to school, and they all got beheaded. You know, and I would point out that, you know, we have beheadings here too in the United States. We really do, but usually we call those people serial killers.
do not have a cause. These killers
don't have religious clerics. They're not out front. No. They hide.
They hide. They're ashamed of what they've done. These people brag about what they've done.
I think it is a huge difference, isn't it? I think Islam hides too. They hide every time they get out in a secular society and start promoting their acceptance and their love, and Islam means peace when we know it means submit and on and on. So in that sense, they hide. But once you're in their community, hey, there's no hiding anymore.
No.
It's right out your face.
Speaking of hiding, the United States, this president has said that we're at war with a specific organization. It was Al-Qaeda, if I have my memory serves me correctly here.
Yeah.
I just shared 10 stories about events that were taking place in the one place where Al-Qaeda is said to exist today. Did Al-Qaeda's name ever come up? Did any one of these people say, I am Al-Qaeda, that I am representing Al-Qaeda, that I was influenced by Al-Qaeda? Did Al-Qaeda even come up once in all of this list of these atrocities? And this is the heartland of Al-Qaeda, if Al-Qaeda even exists anymore.
No, it didn't. And you take a lot of knocks because you've exposed Islam for what it is. And sadly, you know, people just don't want to come to it. Look, you point out in your book Yada Ya at the very end of the Battle of Megiddoum, what we call Armageddon.
Yes.
Where they're going in for Sukkah.
Right.
5 days after Kippurim, and you clearly show that these people are screaming Allah with repetitious prostrations to the ground. These are the people in the final battle that are attacking Jerusalem, the place from which all salvation flows. That's it. So, and your translation is correct, since we know Yahweh is not about people bowing down to him.
Yeah.
Because that's the alternative translation. People coming up and bowing down all year to him.
Yeah. No, in fact, it's the text in Hebrew is punctuated with the people who are prostrating themselves, screaming out Allah, as they conduct themselves in this final raid of Jerusalem, trying to destroy God's chosen people. Islam is today the impetus behind 99.9% of terrorist acts. It's not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is irrelevant. If Al-Qaeda even exists today, it is completely irrelevant. The problem is Islam, and we as a nation have only one hope of preventing them utterly destroying this country, and that's for us to acknowledge that the enemy who wishes to destroy this country is Islam, not terrorism, and that terrorism is nothing more than a tactic. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Hope Larry can stay with us. We're going to turn our attention to Yahweh in just a moment.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact.